Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Verlinde, the publisher and founder of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhaus playing in the background. Today, we have a fun interview to share with you. Jazz great John Pizzarelli came by the Fretboard Journal once again. He's been here a few times. He's performed in our infamous little corner space where we film all sorts of amazing musicians. This was a fun visit. While he was here, we filmed him playing his original tune, Oh, How My Heart Beats for You. That is now on fretboardjournal.com as well as our YouTube channel. And we interviewed him for this podcast. Brian Saunders did the interview. You don't have to hear my voice on this interview. Brian and John go way back, so they got into a deep discussion, and I'm glad we were able to hit the record button for it. In other Fretboard Journal news, we are hard at work on Fretboard Journal number 43. It's going to be an amazing issue. Molly Tuttle's going to be in there, Loudon guitars, and a lot of fun surprises. And the Fretboard Journal's first ever electric guitar annual has been printed. It is now, I believe, at the bindery, and any minute now it will be moved over to the shipping plant where they will be packaged in their sturdy envelopes and mailed off, hopefully within a few days, to all the folks who have pre-ordered them. If you have not ordered the Fretboard Journal's Electric Guitar Annual yet, it is not included in your Fretboard Journal subscription, so you you should reserve a copy if you are going to want it, and you should do that soon because quantities are going to be limited, and you can do that just at fretboardjournal.com and then hit the shop tab. If you are liking our podcast, if you like all of our videos, if you've been consuming our digital content and want to support us, as always, the best way to do that is by either subscribing to the magazine or ordering our issues like this Electric Guitar Annual. But we have a new option because I know a lot of you younger guys aren't into paper goods these days. We are now, as of this week, offering PDF downloads of entire issues of the Fretboard Journal. We've had an iPad app for years. It was always a bit of an albatross and a big headache for us trying to keep up with all the Apple updates. So we're moving away from that. If you've been on the iTunes newsstand consuming the Fretboard Journal, we're going to transition you. You can drop me a line if you want to know how. You can download issues now. You just go to the downloads page in our shop tab, and we have the last three issues, 40, 41, and 42, available as full-length PDFs that you can read on any device, which is really awesome. And we're going to be going back to the 20s, back to the 20s in our issues too, so we're hard at work on that. Today's first podcast sponsor is our friends at RetroFret. You have heard me sing the praises of RetroFret for years. They are a vintage guitar mecca if you've never been there. They've recently moved to the Carroll Gardens neighborhood of Brooklyn. They're right down the street from the Jalopy Theater, which is another institution you should check out if you are into Fretboard Journalish music. I can't thank our friends at RetroFret enough for sponsoring the podcast. I'm on their new arrivals page right now, and as always, they have a bunch of gems, including not one but two beautiful Epiphone archtop guitars from the 30s. They've got a Broadway from 1939, and they also have an Epiphone Deluxe from 1938. They also have a beautiful slab board 1961 Fender Jazzmaster Sunburst that I have my eyes on. If you want to see what their entire inventory is about, and it includes a ton of vintage Martins and Gibsons and flat tops and arch tops and electrics, go over to RetroFret.com. You can click on the new arrivals page like I just did, or just poke around. I can also say, without a shadow of a doubt, RetroFret has one of the great repair and restoration departments in the country with some of the best luthiers in the world. So, check those guys out if you are anywhere near the New York City area or just like to go window shopping and tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. Speaking of luthiers, I do want to give a plug. We do have a couple of podcasts under the Fretboard Journal umbrella right now, including Luthier on Luthier, hosted by Michael Bashkin. And he just did an incredible interview with our friend Joe Glazer that went up yesterday. So check that out if you need to have more podcasts in your on your phone or however you consume them. They had a great talk that went beyond just the minutiae of guitar repair. Joe's a fascinating guy. He was at the last Fretboard Summit. We love talking to him, and he's been showing up in our magazine more and more as guys like David Rawlings hit him up for repairs and stuff. So get the insight into him and his interesting career by checking out the Luthier and Luthier podcast. Our other Fretboard Journal podcast sponsor today is Lee Valley. You probably have heard me talk about Lee Valley a few times now. LeeValley.com is a one-stop shop for tools for all sorts of woodworking projects, including now guitar making. For years, they were asked to make and supply tools for luthiers out there, and now they finally have them. They have everything needed from initial guitar body construction all the way to finished work. You can go to LeeValley.com to see what they are about. They have all sorts of amazing, beautiful woodworking tools, those planes that you see at your favorite luthier's workbench that look like they are works of art. They have all that stuff. So go to LeeValley.com. If you do order anything, by all means, tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. And without further ado, I think we're going to get to our talk with John Pizzarelli. I do hope you like it. We have some really fun podcast guests coming up, including John McEwen, Tyler Grant, the flat picking guitar whiz, and a bunch more. So if you haven't subscribed to the Fretboard Journal podcast yet, I hope you will do so. And I hope you will leave us a review on iTunes, because it definitely helps other people find our little podcast. Here's our talk with John Pizzarelli.
Welcome to the Fretboard Journal, John.
It's a pleasure to be back here.
Indeed. I was, where was it? The Facebook reminded me that it was, I think, 6 years ago yesterday that you made your first visit.
Oh, wow.
To the offices here.
But when was the Bill Frisell?
That was
4 years ago, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, wow. Yeah. 6 years ago. We probably did it on a Saturday and then went to eat.
Sounds like us.
Sounds like us.
You do something like a podcast yourself. You have Radio Deluxe that yes. You do with your wife.
Yeah.
What's the story there?
It's actually on 40 actual radio stations, what they call terrestrial radio. So it's on about 40 cities. In its best inclination, is it if it's an inclination or incubation?
Incarnation.
That's what it was. I knew it was one of those things.
You can cut that out, right?
It's on like at 5 in the afternoon in Minneapolis, 5 to 7. So like in Minneapolis, it's amazing. We're on in Los Angeles at 6 a.m. on Sunday morning, which is doesn't help us.
Not so much. But
there, am I allowed to say where it's on also?
Sure.
It's on a thing called Mixcloud.com, and they run it on a weekly basis. We're on up in the Catskills. On a system called WAMC. They go all the way up the cats. We know where everybody who listens to our show vacations, because that's basically, and we're out in the Hamptons too, out in the, and so there's a station out there that carries us. So we know when people are stuck in traffic coming back from the Hamptons or driving down from the Catskills. Well, we caught your show. Oh, you know, where you have a place up in the Catskills. How'd you know? It's weird that I should pick that up. But there are some, I've talked way too much about it already. But Jessica, my wife, and I, basically we talk and play music from the Great American Songbook and beyond. We're not afraid to play, in a sense, I've snuck in Marcus Miller and Bill Frisell and Kurt Rosenwinkel and Pat Metheny around Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald, Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan, Frank Sinatra, Nat Cole.
Excellent.
We like to call it an eclectic mix.
It is. I love the show. It's a great listen.
Thank you.
Now, you're in town with the trio, doing the Drummerless Nat Trio again.
Yeah.
Nat's centennial is coming up.
Yep.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about how Nat affects your
yes.
arrangement and...
Well, I have to say, if I could do a brief history, do we have like an unlimited time or just...
Unlimited. This
wow.
thing can go on for days if you want.
we'll just bring in food. the thing that really started me off was I used to go hear my father's trio. He had a guitar, bass, and piano trio at the Pierre Hotel in the late 70s. And I would go hear it. And I would think, wow, this is such an unusual thing. This is so amazing. That there's no drums, and he's playing rhythm guitar, and then he's soloing, and it's such a unique sound. I was a sheltered child, and I only listened to whatever records we had in the house, or, you know, just, and at that time I wanted to be Peter Frampton. So, but this, I was following my father about. He was playing with Benny Goodman as a rhythm guitarist, and here was this little group of his where I hadn't heard him really play that much single note stuff and be a leader. So this, and when he played in Orlando with the Bubba Cobb Trio at Disney World, they had a jazz room. And I saw him, and I'm going, wow, this is really cool that he does this. Mm-hmm. So it turned out that somewhere in, it's like 1980, in January of 1980, I was working with my buddy from high school. We were in college at the time. He sang like Dick Hames and Frank Sinatra. Mm-hmm. And had been playing gigs singing like Kenny Rankin and James Taylor and Michael Frank songs. And I played with my father a little bit, so I knew standards. And he said, why don't we do a little duo thing? I think we called it Buck and Joe, or Joe and Buck, or something like that. He was Joe Francis. His real name was Joe Sitkowski. I was John Pizzarelli, but for some reason I was Bucky Pizzarelli Jr., I even think, for a moment, which was disgusting. And so we played this gig on Monday nights at a place called Julio's. And his sister, Nancy, at one point said, you know, would be a cool song for you? I have this record by a guy named Frank Weber. And he's a singer-songwriter on RCA. And one of the songs is Straighten Up and Fly Right, and you should learn it. And I was like, oh, okay. So I learned it, and then I played it for my father. I said, hey, this Frank Weber guy did this song called Straighten Up and Fly Right. And my father said, well, that's Nat King Cole. And as I always like to say, the you idiot was in parentheses. He goes, you got to get those records, or you're not going to know what hit you. That's how my father talks. So I went to Sam Goody's, like a good boy that I am, and I came home with the best of the Nat Cole Trio Parts 1 and 2. The thing that is amazing to me is that Capitol Records had just released these two records.
Meant to be.
It was meant to be. It really was. And so I brought them home, and I was like, oh, you're dead. Put it on hi-fi and Paper Moon, and I went, oh, my God. And I was like, wait a second, piano, bass, and guitar. Oh, and then he said, when I was in the Army, I was in the Philippines in 1946, and here was Paper Moon on those little metal speakers in the trees around the base. And he was going like, what the hell is that? What's that arrangement about, of Paper Moon? And I started to hear all the things that he was doing on like a record with Slam Stewart, just the duo thing. And there was that moment where they went, and I was like, what is he doing? Why did he freak out for a moment there? He was recreating all this Nat Cole stuff. And I was, oh, so there's Nat Cole and Oscar Moore and that group. And there's Bucky Pizzarelli going, oh, I can do that. We don't need drums. We can have a group at the Pierre Hotel doing that. Now, really, until 1980, there weren't any, there were rare that people had all those Nat Cole records. They had all the best of Nat Cole, Unforgettable and Red Sails and the Sunset and Portrait of Jenny and I'm Lost and Serenata and those kinds of things. So I heard the Shearing record at Joe's house. His father had the Nat Cole and George Shearing record. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, what's this pick yourself up business and all that? So all these things were coming in, and then I just learned, I thought, this is so much easier than singing Night and Day. And I get a kick out of you in Witchcraft. Route 66, Straighten Up and Fly Right, Paper Moon, Frim Fram Sauce. That's custom built for me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, whoa, I'm hitching my sail to that. That was why I wanted to do it. And that was just exciting. And so I just wanted to do that. And so cut to 1990 when I made my Blue Heaven record. Mm-hmm. I had made three with a lot of Nat Cole songs on them. But My Blue Heaven was really like the record where I sort of shopped it. And it was David or Norman Chesky said, you got to get a booking agent and a manager and get out there. So I made a little press kit and I went to some booking agents and basically they would see like, oh, you played with Zoot Sims. How's Zoot doing? I said, well, he's dead. But there was one guy who said, I had a tape of stuff, and then he heard the second tape came in of the My Blue Heaven thing when I had it. And he had sort of passed, and then he said, wait a second, that's really good. Can you do that? I said, yeah. And so I'll put together a trio, and I put together a trio, and with Ken Levinsky, whose father was Walt Levinsky, a great studio musician and clarinet player and lead alto player, and my brother Martin, and that's when we started. And then Ray Kennedy joined at a lull in the group's presence, and then we just, you know, we just attacked the world with that sound, with that group. And then, so we, the last record with the trio was the Live at Birdland record. We had, and the last one in the studio was Kisses in the Rain. So to go back to this now, and hopefully we'll have someone put it out next March, but we've decided to revisit that thing for monetary and musical reasons. It was just, it's so much easier to travel with this group. Last year we went out with all the Brazilians and extra singers and all this stuff. And this year, let's go back to our roots and do this. And it's really, I keep forgetting how amazing it is to do.
Excellent.
Was that that was a long answer. I apologize.
That's a great answer, though. It's
sort of the history, really, of what happened. And but the that sound of that group is so, it's still amazing to me what they were doing. And I'm still trying to remember. I read the Nat Cole book that Mark Epstein wrote in the late 90s. And there's still a lot of unanswered questions that I'm still, that we'll even address today. But it's such an amazing thing that they were doing.
Cool. So there were only like seven or eight times in there that I wanted to interrupt you with questions about this, that, or the other thing. But one of the obvious things is your father, Bucky Pizzarelli, the legend. Growing up with him in the house, some of the time at least.
Yes.
Now, you've told me off mic before about some of the people that would come through the house. Then you mentioned as well that he played Benny Goodman.
Yeah.
Slam Stewart. What was it like, you know, like Benny Goodman in the house?
Well, the thing that is, well, Benny Goodman was almost, we were almost, that was sort of off limits. Benny Goodman was like, you're not allowed downstairs. So we would sort of, it was like, you know, we would hide on the stairs just to see him sitting. Because, and that was a smart thing. they didn't need us running around. But the thing that was, that's sort of shameful on my part, and sort of, I think it also worked, was that I didn't know that much about anything but my father, really. But, I mean, I knew Benny Goodman was. I wrote a paper on him, and they gave it to him. Like, that was my paper on, you know, why Benny Goodman was the king of swing. So I knew that. But, like, Zoot Sims, I sort of knew all the Woody Herman thing and all that, and I had played with him and with my, you know, and I knew how great he was and all that. But I didn't have to, I was smart enough to only be inquisitive about things maybe I had answers for. So that was, I think that didn't, and Slam Stewart, one day I even asked Slam, I was sitting with him, and I said, what was Nat Cole like? And he was like, well, he was good, and then one day he started singing. I was like, okay, well, thanks. But like, to not even know that, what, you know, to not really be that informed on Slam's playing with Charlie Parker and Art Tatum and all that, but just to have played with him and thought, well, this guy's a hell of a bass player, you know, and know about him, but not that much, I think, was sort of worked and sort of, and now looking back on, all the questions I could have asked, you know. But then, you know, my Joe Pass came to town, and my father went in the city on a Saturday, picked him up and brought him out to the house for food. And we had an L5. My father was trying out an acoustic guitar on the couch, no cutaway. And my father said, why don't you play something? And Joe was on the cover of Guitar Player magazine that, it was like 76, I guess. And my sister knew the chords to Sonny Gets Blue because she played it with my father. And so she started to play boom, F minor, da G minor, do, 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 boom, green, do. And he was going, ba, ba, do, 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 dee, do, ba, do, ba, do, dee, do, dee, do, 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 do. I was, what? Whoa, wait, whoa, everybody stop. You know, and it was like, oh, there is a magical person sitting on the love seat playing the guitar. And I was like, oh, and he was just playing with his fingers and, it was really amazing.
Just noodling, not even
just playing the hell out of "Sonny Gets Blue," and I was like, "Oh!" And then I remember him saying, "I can't figure out that 7-string guitar because, you know, he played all the bass lines on the 6-string anyway." He goes, "I always thought I would go junk goong 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 goong," you know, when he tried to play the 7-string, and he didn't need it. And it was really, it was like, oh, okay. And same Ray Brown came one day and was just talking about, came in for brunch at our house and just talking about golf and playing in the studio and all the stuff that he did. And I was just, okay. And, you know, that was maybe 5 or 6 years before Ray Kennedy, you know, brought all those Oscar Peterson records. I mean, it's embarrassing. I just knew about what my father was doing and all the things my father would say to listen to, which was like Don Costa's arrangements or Johnny Mandel's arrangements on things and listening to the guys who were involved in the records and almost leaving the vocalists sometimes behind or some of the guys who were really the stars of the guitar. I didn't really know that much about, only knew from what my father had told me.
Yeah. That's something I've wondered about is, you know, you said you wanted to be Peter Frampton, you know, for a long time. So you were, I'm sure, playing solid body guitars and bending notes. And yeah.
I had a Madeira, the Guild made those Madeira guitars. It had the one with the weird body I had.
So
and put a DiMarzio pickup in it.
How did you make the transition from wanting to play like Peter Frampton to wanting to play like Oscar Moore? How much of it was just osmosis from being growing up around it, and how much of it was woodshed, and how much of it was like applying?
Well, a lot of it was luck, because when I worked at this day camp, night's day camp, there was another counselor, and he went, "You're Bucky Pizzarelli's son. I study with Barry Galbraith," and which Barry was a great teacher, and he taught in the Ed Sullivan Building where they do Colbert now, and he had an office there, and with Alan Hanlon, Sal Salvador. And whenever Mundell Lowe came into town, and this kid, I just saw him, Mike Taplinger is his name. And he said, you know, when I did my lessons, Mundell Lowe would sit in and watch the lessons that, Barry gave me and Barry would write out these things. So he said, let's do a duo together. So I was trying to do this duo thing with this guy. My father said, you got to play the seventh string. You got to play that. So he showed me a few chords, and I started to like play because Bucky showed me what to do. And at the same time, there was a kid from Park Ridge, who Tom Messavage, who played trombone, got the international symbol for trombone.
And it doesn't work on a podcast, yeah, unfortunately.
Oh, sorry. And so,
it's like when I'm nodding along with your story. Nobody knows.
Well, he wanted to play Spain for his senior recital, and his friends knew me. I went to a different school, but he said, can you learn? And we all learned Spain off the record. So my father's like, what the hell is that? I said, we all learned it off the record. And that's when he said, okay, if you can learn all those rock and roll solos and that off a record, why don't you learn George Barnes' single note thing from Honeysuckle Rose, and we'll play it as a duet. So that's when I started, he heard that I was doing that. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, you should do that. So I started to learn things off the records, the arrangements, and then I was playing six string. I had a little Aria six string. It was like a knockoff of the 175. And then I'd play that with Bucky, my father. And then one day he just said, you got to play seven string with me. And then you can accompany me when I solo and vice versa. And it was literally like on a gig where he just said, tonight you'll play that guitar. Oh, well, what about all the six string things? You'll do it. It's like, okay. And that's how it was literally... He heard what I was doing and then figured, oh, if you can learn Show Me the Way off the record, well, then you can learn Honeysuckle Rose or this Django Reinhardt of Rose Room, Django record of Rose Room. He was like, learn that. So that's how it was starting.
So now the seven string comes up again, and that's another thing that a lot of people kind of, they look at you with eyes wide open at the seven string business. And so it's... What kind of a transition? So it's tuned to a low A.
Right.
So it kind of changes the intervals a little bit.
It changes the intervals, but the forms all stay the same for the most part. You can play a C7 and just your low C now is your bass note. You don't have to play like a G in the bass. Some guys would play a G in the bass. So they have the lowest note on the thing when they would finish a song. Now you have the low C. So you have C's and D flats, E flats, B's. And it changes some of the chords a little bit, but not that you can play the same forms on a six string guitar.
Yeah.
And I think the point was, is he showed me the song, Watch What Happens. And it basically has all the forms you need to know in one song. It's a great exercise because the first chord is E flat major 7, da da da, do 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 do, and F7, F minor 7, B flat 7, and E up in the line, and it, and oh, there it all is. So then it all sort of falls into place. And when you're 16, you don't know any better, so you just do it. And, you know, I didn't know what all the plus this or minus that was. And Buggy said, you don't need to know any of that. Just play the sevenths and major and minor, and you're all right. So that was, and then he would play songs and pound them out for me, you know, and you'd had to listen or else you didn't eat.
No supper for you.
No supper until you learn that honeysuckle rose. But the thing that we get back to was I was a product of listening to Bucky Pizzarelli play the guitar. So Bucky Pizzarelli listened to Eddie Lang, to Django Reinhardt, to Oscar Moore, to Les Paul, to George Barnes. And when he, like when he got the seventh string, and they would go to George, he went to George Barnes, had a studio right up the street from us. That Phil Ramone gave him all the equipment to record. So he'd go up there and they would play, they'd go through music books. They said, okay, take this book out and just go through, and Bucky would play the chords and George would play the melody. And they'd turn the page and record another one and record and record. And they started to develop these arrangements. And so Bucky was said to me years later, he said, when we would listen to like George Barnes, they have those radio transcriptions of him playing. They say, here's little George Barnes at 16. Wow. And one day we're listening to Bucky said, if I knew he was that good at 16, I'd have never played with him when I was 35. You know, and but so Bucky's single note playing was from sitting next to George Barnes for 4 years every night, I think. And so when I started to play with Bucky, my single people say, how do you learn single string? Well, you sit next to a guy who's played with George Barnes every night for 4 years, and you watch him and you listen. So that's where I was a product of learning from watching Bucky, who was a sponge for all that stuff that he had learned. So the rhythm playing came from watching Bucky and those kinds of things. So when we got to Oscar Moore, was going, well, this guy does everything. He's playing rhythm in that group. He's playing single notes. He's playing the upper four of the guitar, he's playing the bottom four, he's playing the middle. He's finding little triads to play in between and giving Nat enough room so when Nat's going, it is only a paper moon, ba-boo-ba, on the piano, playing, and he's junk, junk, junk. Sometimes you hear him playing two notes as rhythm notes. And it all works. And then his single note playing, it was sort of, it's sort of staggering. His solo on Body and Soul, for example, to me is one of the great solos on the song, you know.
Geez, how much, I hadn't thought of the two-note rhythm work hadn't really occurred to me, but how much of Freddie Green do you think is in Moore's playing?
That's a very interesting point. I was in preparing for this today because people, a lot of are asking me about Oscar Moore. So I was looking up the things because we were saying, off the air, Oscar Moore sounds a lot like Les Paul. And I was I was going, well, Les Paul sounds a lot like Oscar Moore, too. And I guess, well, obviously, the Basie band's out there, and there's this idea of that rhythm guitar. But I think rhythm guitar is also something that people were doing. It was part of the arsenal that you needed to have, I think, in the 30s and 40s. So I just figure Oscar found a way to make it work inside of that thing. When you listen to Herb Ellis, so 45, when the Nat Cole Trio really hits it, say 44, 45, you listen to Herb Ellis in 55, 56 at the Stratford Shakespeare Fest, and he's just sort of playing like rhythm guitar with Ray and Oscar. So that's sort of interesting where they have this idea that that's got to be there. So maybe that's Freddie Green too, you know.
I saw this that crazy Jazz Casual show from KQED in San Francisco. That's all over. That's, you can find all the clips on YouTube. And there was a show with Count Basie, just in a quartet. So it was him and Freddie Green and bass and drummer. I can't remember their names, but it was kind of, it struck me how all of a sudden it felt like Nat Cole because it was stripped down without the thing. And especially for a trio that was coming up really on when big bands were the thing.
Right.
How much of that big band influence determined how they arranged? And
yeah, that's what, you know, Will Friedwald asked me in New York. He said, well, I want to talk about Paper Moon. I don't know how they figured out Paper Moon. It's amazing how they use those shout choruses, those little things in that, in the Nat Cole Trio. That's so interesting. Or, you know, they had on Errand Boy for Rhythm, where they all go, mm-hmm. you know, they have kickers and things. Mm-hmm. It's, that's one of the reasons I feel like going, like when Bobby Troup tells me the story, like the first night he's in LA, he goes to hear the Nat Cole Trio. I was like, I want to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that, it's just stunning how they made that excitement work with three guys. I guess they felt like, well, it's just three of us, so what can we take from everything we've listened to? Mm-hmm. And so they add those kind of elements of the kickers that get to the soloist, the shout choruses where they're going, you know, they can, they're playing those things, you know, those little, those shout chords, you know, da 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 ba 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 ba, and it's like bassy.
Yeah.
It's really what it is. So yeah. It is, there are those really interesting elements of that. And when you hear, so maybe it's more, maybe people are really trying more Count Basie than they think. I also do think that that's what, I just changed my answer in my head, was that's what I think Count Basie, Django Reinhardt was doing. They heard that Count Basie band. I think that, that came from that, I think, too. They were hearing that, well, we must try to do this. That was my impersonation of Django Reinhardt.
That's exactly what he sounds like.
Right? Yeah. People I probably thought it must have been on a tape or something. But I think that's all that, that was that sound. You know, they heard that. So, well, let's do that.
Excellent.
I think, anyway.
Yeah. Well, geez, that's a, that's it, a lot to digest.
There's a lot in there. I tell you, it's crazy. And actually, I will share a nutty story, too. I think it was Irving Ashby, who was the guitar player after Oscar Moore. Mm-hmm. Mel Bay and Johnny Smith get in a cab in L.A., and they're going somewhere to hear somebody. And they're talking in the back seat, and the guy driving the cab says, well, you're Mel Bay, and you're Johnny Smith, and it's wild to have you in my cab. And he said, well, oh, it's really good. And he goes, I'm Irving Ashby, driving the cab. And they were like, oh, my God. And I think they took him into the club with them. So we'll put the cab away, we'll come out, hang out with us tonight. But that's, I mean, because even Oscar Moore, after Nat, really, there's not a lot that happened after Nat Cole. And it's a very beautiful moment on the This Is Your Life Nat Cole, which I haven't been able to find anywhere. They don't have the whole thing. I saw it one night somewhere on, I guess, late night television. Mm-hmm. This Is Your Life Nat Cole. And he was totally drugged. He was totally like, oh, no, you didn't do this. Like, it's like a Sid Caesar sketch, you know, where he's running away. And they, at one moment, then the curtain opens and there's Wesley Prince and Johnny Miller on bass and Oscar Moore. And when he sees Oscar Moore, he's just like, wow, you know, and that's sort of, that's got to be 60, 61. And Oscar hadn't done that much at that point.
Yeah.
So it's, and I, and in the book, it says that, you know, one of the guys who was really broken up at Nat's funeral is Oscar Moore. And it was just sort of. And when after Oscar Moore died, his son found all of the awards in the garage. Metronome Guitar Player of the Year, this one, that one, you know, all those. They were just in the corner of the garage in a box, you know. One of the great guitar players on the planet.
Yeah, kind of defined it for
that's why I try not to win awards. Because, you know, I wouldn't want to put him in my garage.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming by, John.
I'm glad I got to yak away. I love to talk about that kind of stuff, so I appreciate Brian having us here at the Fretboard Journal.
Excellent.